طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it every week on This Week in Palestine. This week we continue our coverage of the effects of the massive lies perpetrated by the Israeli government concerning the bogus charges that Hamas fighters, during their raid on October 7th, raped and mutilated women, murdered and beheaded babies, etc. Even President Biden and his administration have echoed the false claims, and the media has followed. The New York Times is being eviscerated for supporting these fraudulent claims now that the events of October 7th are coming under the scrutiny of investigation by the independent media. We begin with the findings of the investigation by the Electronic Intifada. Here are Nora Barrows-Friedman and Ali Abu Nima discussing the most recent revelations in the investigation of this massive fraud.
You have an update. The situation, the so-called mass rape investigation published by the New York Times in December. We didn't want to revisit this, but we have to. Tell us about what's the updates here.
Yeah, first to remind our viewers, months ago, the New York Times published an article with the headline "Screams Without Words: How Hamas Weaponized Sexual Violence on October 7th. And it was supposedly the result of a two-month-long investigation led by Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Jeffrey Gettelman. The Times claimed to present evidence that Hamas fighters raped Israeli women on October 7th and that, quote, the attacks against women were not isolated events, but part of a broader pattern of gender-based violence. But as we showed on our January 3rd live stream, the Times' so-called investigation was deeply flawed, and I would go as far as to say fraudulent. People can watch that segment on our YouTube channel.
Yeah, and we can link to that. But I know that some staffers inside the New York Times itself have reached similar conclusions to the one that we and other independent outlets have reached. Is that right?
That's right. On January 28th, The Intercept revealed that The Times pulled a high-profile episode of its podcast, The Daily, that was based on Gettelman's mass rapes article. According to The Intercept, the decision not to air the episode was taken, quote, amid a furious internal debate about the strength of the paper's original reporting on the subject. And I want to note that The Daily is more than just an ordinary podcast. It is broadcast every weekday on public radio stations around the United States, so millions of people hear it. It's very influential. According to The Intercept, the episode was supposed to air on January 9th, but as criticism of Gettelman's reporting grew internally and externally, The Daily shelved the original script and put a hold on the episode. Now, they then wrote a new script, one that was, according to The Intercept, allowed for uncertainty and asked open-ended questions that were absent from the original article. In other words, The Daily was going to cast doubt on The Times' own reporting. But even that new script remains the subject of significant controversy within the Times newsroom and has yet to air. According to The Intercept, some New York Times staffers fear another caliphate-level journalistic debacle.
Right, and remind our viewers what that is.
Right. Caliphate was a sensational multi-part podcast by New York Times reporter Rukmini Kalamaki. It was released in 2018. It purported to be the story of a young Canadian Muslim who was radicalized and went on to Syria to join ISIS and commit a number of gruesome atrocities that were described in detail in the podcast. But the man turned out to be a total fraud. He made everything up. And the New York Times ignored many of the red flags that his story was fake. The Times ended up retracting the podcast, and it was obviously a huge embarrassment. This malpractice is not harmless. The podcast undoubtedly fed anti-Muslim fear-mongering in both Canada and the U.S. by boosting the notion that young Muslims in these countries present a grave danger. And I would say that the New York Times' reporting of Israeli atrocity propaganda since October 7, such as the claims of mass rape, is also extremely harmful because it provides Israel with a justification for and distraction from its genocidal crimes against Palestinians in Gaza. And it really seems to me that the New York Times as an institution has not learned the lessons from the Caliphate debacle, although it appears that at least some of its staff have, which is why they are now raising the alarm over the Gettleman article.
Have there been any New York Times editors who have responded to this controversy over the mass rapes article? Is anyone taking this seriously from inside?
One New York Times staffer told The Intercept, quote, "There seems to be no self-awareness at the top." The staffer added that Gettleman's story, quote, "deserved more fact-checking and much more reporting. All basic standards applied to countless other stories," end quote. But instead of assigning editors to review Gettleman's work with some objectivity, it appears the Times has allowed him to investigate himself. Sources at the Times told The Intercept that Gettleman was assigned to write a follow-up story and gather evidence to support his original claims that were in the story back in December.
Right. Amazing. And that article that Gettleman did, investigating himself, has now been published. Does it resolve any of the problems with his original quote-unquote report? Did he come up with any new evidence? Is there anything now to back up the spurious claims that have been debunked?
Yeah, it was published on January 29th. And while it does contain new unverified claims and a lot of spin and evasion, there is nothing in it that you could call new evidence. Mm-hmm. Gettleman really tries to skirt around or simply ignores the key problems with his reporting that we and others have pointed out.
Right. Convenient. What are some of those key problems?
Well, first, there is the issue of Gal Abdush. She is an Israeli woman who was killed on October 7th. In his original article, Gettleman portrays her as the central victim of this so-called pattern of rape allegedly carried out by Hamas. But several members of Gal Abdush's family pushed back very strongly against Gettleman's claims. They say that there is no proof that Gal Abdush was raped, and they said that the Times manipulated them. They had no idea that the story Gettleman was working on was going to claim that Abdush was raped.
Yeah.
Gettleman provides absolutely no new evidence on this and actually has to acknowledge that, quote, "family members have denied or cast doubt on the claims that she was raped." He then asserts that critics have used the comments of Gal Abdush's family, quote, "to assert falsely that the family had renounced the article," end quote. But that is not false. Family members did renounce the claims in Gettleman's article, and Gettleman has come up with no new evidence to back them up. And Gal Abdush's mother said she only learned of the claim that her daughter had been sexually assaulted from the New York Times article itself.
Atrocious. In our previous segment on this, you pointed out how the four supposed eyewitnesses to the alleged rapes each lacked credibility. You pointed out that their stories were inherently unlikely or even impossible, that there was a total lack of corroboration, including bodies and other physical and forensic evidence, or because the supposed eyewitnesses changed their stories over time. Does Gettleman address any of that in this new piece?
He does address it, but only in a way that raises even more questions about his shoddy reporting, fraudulent reporting, I would say. For example, there's the case of Sapir, a woman who supposedly saw Hamas fighters gang rape and murder five women, then cut off the breast of one of them and start tossing it around like a ball. She also claimed she saw Hamas fighters prancing around with severed heads of three women lifted up over their heads. As we pointed out previously, her incredible atrocity tale came with no corroboration. Where were the severed heads? Where were the headless bodies? Where was all the blood and DNA? All this horror could not have happened while leaving no trace behind. Now, Gettleman makes this claim, citing Israeli authorities. I quote, "The police also said they found Sapir's bag where she said she had been hiding and women's clothing near where she said the rapes occurred. And three severed heads were found farther away near the bodies of assailants in military fatigues," Israeli officials said, without providing more detail, end quote. None of these details were in his original story, and it all sounds very convenient. I've been following this issue very closely, and this is the first time in almost 4 months that we hear it claimed that this sort of physical evidence exists. But why didn't Gettleman insist on seeing crime scene photos or any other physical evidence? Again, there's nothing new here except more claims and assertions from the authorities of the same regime that is perpetrating genocide in Gaza, claims that neither we nor Gettleman can verify, but which Gettleman and the New York Times are happy to regurgitate, apparently without a shred of skepticism. And then there's the second and the only other eyewitness to the same alleged incident, a man called Ura Carroll. As we pointed out, in an earlier account, Carroll told Israeli media he did not see the rape, but only that Sapir had told him about it. But in Gettleman's original article, Carroll is quoted as saying he saw these events with his own eyes. In the new article, Gettleman does not challenge Carroll with his previous contradictory statements, but simply allows him to reassert his claims. Again, absolutely nothing new. I should point out that neither Sapir nor Carroll were named in the earlier account in Haaretz where the second witness says he did not see the rape. But there's enough similarity that we can conclude with confidence that this is the same alleged incident.
There was another supposed eyewitness to a separate alleged rape, a man called Roz Cohen. And last time we talked about this, you pointed out how Cohen's story had changed repeatedly since October 7th. Does Gettleman address that? If so, how does he address it?
Yeah, that's right. We and other outlets have pointed out how Cohen's accounts have kept changing over time, including how in his initial statements about October 7th, Cohen made no mention of rape. And now this is the laughable excuse that Gettleman comes up with to cover up for Cohen's shifting narratives. Gettleman writes, quote, "Asked this month why he had not mentioned rape at first, Mr. Cohen cited the stress of his experience and said in a text message that he had not realized then that he was one of the few surviving witnesses. He declined to be interviewed again, saying he was working to recover from the trauma he suffered," end quote. And Gettleman also tries to appeal to authority to cover up for Cohen's evasions and lies. He quotes a person he describes as a Ukrainian lawyer specializing in international law, including crimes against women. And this lawyer says that a variation in the testimony given by the eyewitness, quote, does not necessarily invalidate the witness's experience. And she also puts Cohen's shifting story down to trauma. Isn't that convenient? I guess it's a case of what they say online, trust me, bro.
Yeah.
And also notice that Gettleman claims that Cohen was, quote, one of the few surviving witnesses, end quote. It's always important to remind ourselves that Israeli authorities and Gettleman and lots of other media have been claiming all along that there was a pattern of rapes, a deliberate mass campaign of sexual violence as a weapon of war. And yet in his new article, Gettleman has not come up with any other examples in addition to the alleged cases he reported and which are simply not credible. There should be tons of witnesses and tons of evidence, including forensics and video, but there just isn't. There is one more supposed eyewitness who is with Raz Cohen, a fashion designer named Shoam Guetta. Guetta claims he saw the same assault as Cohen, but there's nothing to corroborate it. Gettleman does not add anything new about Guetta, just repetition of what he claimed in the earlier article. But it's notable that Guetta has been a publicity seeker from the start. In the last few weeks, he's been deployed in Gaza with the Israeli army, and he posted this photo on Facebook where he actually advertises his collection, his fashion collection called Gutos, on the wall of a house in Gaza. You can see that photo here.
I don't know what to say about that, other than absolutely despicable. Ali, the last time you talked about how Gettleman relied to a large extent on Zaka, the Jewish extremist group that goes to crime scenes to collect bodies or body parts for burials, but which even by its own admission has no expertise in forensics or pathology. I don't think they're even like officially licensed by any sort of like public health body. Zaka leaders and its personnel have lied repeatedly about what they saw on October 7th, including the completely debunked stories of burned children and a pregnant woman whose belly was sliced open. Just these horrific, you know, fantasy myths. Does Gettleman explain in his new article why he relied on an organization, Zaka, that has lied so much and has a vested interest in these lies?
No. Zaka is not even mentioned in Gettleman's new article. It appears there was no way for him to spin away his egregious malpractice of relying on such an organization, so he just ignores the matter. Mm-hmm. It's really a fatal blow to his credibility. I suspect that Gettleman's shoddy effort to get himself off the hook is not going to silence the internal dissent within the New York Times and may even heighten it. After all, why is Gettleman being allowed to investigate himself to try to airbrush away his deceptions? And why are editors letting him do it? The New York Times, if it had a shred of integrity, would retract Gettleman's story completely.
Yeah. Ali, is there anything else we should know about this?
Well, I just want to add that The Intercept's reporting is very welcome, and their article goes into a lot more detail about the Times' institutional anti-Palestinian bias, much more than we have time to go into here. But I did find it disappointing that they did not give credit to those of us who did the heavy lifting to debunk Gettleman's story in particular and Israel's evidence-free claims of mass rape in general. Less surprisingly, Gettleman didn't link to us either. So I just want to give a shout out to Mondo Weiss in the Gray Zone. And there are others as well, people who've used their Twitter accounts to expose some of this. Because together with the Electronic Intifada, I think we have all done very important work on this. We'll cut this segment of the live stream as a separate video, and we'll be sure to include links in the description to some of those key articles on the collapsing mass rapes narrative from all of these publications, including, of course, the Electronic Intifada.
Thank you so much, Ali, for that update, very necessary update. And and sadly, we'll probably have to keep updating because the story will go away.
Yeah, as Asa keeps saying, it is a bit like all of these things are a bit like the fake Labour Party anti-Semitism crisis in the UK. You think you're done with it, and then it just keeps coming back.
Yeah, it's like whack-a-mole.
Following that report by Nora Friedman Barrows and Ali Abu Nima, we have further documentation by Jeremy Scahill, who wrote a massive report in The Intercept magazine. Here he is discussing his report with Noreen Sheikh and Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman. A key Israeli intelligence document used by over a dozen countries, including the United States, to justify defunding UNRWA, the primary aid group for Palestinian refugees, contains no evidence to back up Israel's claims, according to several news reports. The allegations made in the Israeli document include accusations that several UNRWA employees participated in the Hamas attack on October 7th. Britain's Channel 4 obtained the document and found that it, quote, provides no evidence to support its explosive new claim that UNRWA staff were involved with terror attacks on Israel. The Financial Times, which also reviewed the materials, came to the same conclusion, as did Sky News. Now, the aid agency, which is critical to providing humanitarian support in Gaza, says it will run out of funds by March as a result of the funding cuts. The allegations made by Israel are just the latest in what journalist Jeremy Scahill calls, quote, Israel's information warfare campaign, which is aimed at, quote, flooding the public discourse with a stream of false, unsubstantiated, and unverifiable allegations. In his latest article published today in The Intercept, Scahill writes, quote, nearly every week, sometimes every day, the Israeli government and military have unloaded a fresh barrage of allegations intended to justify the ongoing slaughter. He adds, quote, the tactic is effective, particularly because the U.S. and other major allies have consistently laundered Israel's unverified allegations as evidence of the righteousness of the cause. Jeremy Scahill is a senior reporter and correspondent at The Intercept. His latest article is headlined, Netanyahu's War on Truth, Israel's Ruthless Propaganda Campaign to Dehumanize Palestinians. He joins us now from Germany. Jeremy, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you could just begin by laying out the case that you make in your latest piece.
Well, in the early morning hours of October 7th, members of Hamas from the Qassam Brigades, the Nukba, their elite special forces, as well as members of Palestinian Islamic Jihad, led a multi-pronged attack in Israel. Everyone is familiar with this. And the initial targets that they hit constituted almost the entirety of Israel's infrastructure in what Tel Aviv calls the Gaza envelope. And they were able to actually quite swiftly overpower the Gaza Division, the main entity of the Israeli state, responsible for enforcing the prison conditions of the people of Gaza, for carrying out drone strikes, for waging war, for conducting all manner of warfare against the people of Gaza. And then the militant Palestinian fighters made their way into a series of settlements in the area. And the intent was quite clear. They were trying to take hostages captive so that they could negotiate the release of their own prisoners. But what they did on that day was nothing short of shattering the paradigm of sending a message that the big lie that is promoted by Israel, not just under Netanyahu, but certainly under Netanyahu, that Israelis could somehow live in peace a stone's throw away from what is effectively a concentration camp filled with 2.3 million people that are deprived anything vaguely resembling a human existence, that is tenable. And Israel was, by all accounts, caught off guard, despite the fact that its own intelligence analysts had been warning that it appeared that Hamas was preparing and training for something that was quite spectacular and not simply some small one-off attempts to fire rockets or even do a minor incursion into Israeli territory. And by all accounts, those were overlooked and dismissed. And what we saw happen then, as the Palestinian fighters made their way across these various Israeli communities and overtook the Gaza Division and took many, many military personnel prisoner and brought them back to Gaza, was the Israeli government engage in sustained counteraction, including with Apache attack helicopters, with drones, when the military did finally arrive in some of these communities. And mind you, it was hours and hours before any official Israeli security forces were responding to some of these civilian areas. They engaged in widespread firefights at Kibbutz Biri. We know that eyewitnesses have said that Israeli forces shelled a house, likely killing at least a dozen Israelis who were being held captive by Palestinian fighters. And so the Israeli government then was reeling from the shock of having these crucial military bases overrun, communities being flooded with Palestinian fighters. And within hours of these attacks happening, the Netanyahu government began to craft a very deliberate propaganda campaign to sell the United States, other Western leaders, and the global public on a scorched earth war of annihilation against Gaza. And this campaign kicked into such high gear immediately. And what they did, what was central to this, is that the Israelis began showing President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, the heads of state of NATO countries and other Western nations, images and videos that they then proceeded to tell an unverified story about what they depicted. And the characterization from Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant was that this was the greatest act of violence against Jewish people since the Holocaust, that the tactics that Hamas used included rape, beheading of babies, mutilation of bodies, torture of families, the bounding of children in groups, including in a nursery in one of the kibbutzes, and then engaging in mass execution of small children, setting children on fire. And President Biden, Secretary Blinken, and many Western leaders then started to repeat these claims. But what happened is that when Israeli Social Security Agency began to actually document the deaths on October 11th, they documented 1,139 deaths. 695 of them were civilians. And we started reviewing the public documentation of the deaths. It turns out that there was only one infant that was killed in all of the attacks combined on October 7th, the nine-month-old baby named Mila Cohen. And she was hit by a bullet during gunfire while she was in her mother's arm. There were also, I think there were 36 children under the age of 19 that died that day. 14 of them were actually killed in Hamas rocket attacks. So when journalists started actually looking then at the official death toll, and you can go, the Israelis have published the stories, the photos of many, many, many of the victims, you realize that these were all lies. It was a massive fraud that was perpetrated on the world, particularly this business about mass decapitation of babies. And Joe Biden, on numerous occasions, said that he saw actual photographic evidence of the beheading of babies and the bounding and burning alive with kerosene whole families. And what I discovered in my research was that these stories appear to have ended up in the heads of Biden and Blinken and others based on the totally fraudulent version of events on October 7th that was offered by private Orthodox rescue operations, the most famous of them is Zaka, telling stories about a pregnant woman who had a fetus cut out of her body, and then the fetus was decapitated in front of the woman and her two children. There's no evidence whatsoever to indicate that that happened. In fact, there's no documentation that any pregnant woman died on October 7th. There was one pregnant woman who was shot while in her car on the way to deliver her baby. She was a Bedouin woman, and the doctors were able to save her life. They tried to deliver the baby. The baby died some hours later, but that wasn't Hamas cutting a baby out of a stomach. And yet these lies were sold, and some of the most obscene things that Israel said that we now know are false were repeated by Anthony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, in testimony in front of the Senate, by Joe Biden himself. And this has gone on and on and on. I've just given you a couple of the most graphic examples of this. But what's clear is that the Israeli government understood that they needed to sell this as like the worst crime against humanity in modern times in order to justify a long-planned siege of Gaza that Benjamin Netanyahu, he represents the most extreme and violent version of the Israeli state project. And it's very, very clear that they sold this fraud and the White House laundered it. And that's why we've seen, and I think the 27,000 people killed in Gaza is a conservative estimate. I think it's much greater than that because there's an estimated 7,000 or 8,000 Palestinians missing, many of them in graves that are the rubble of their former home. So this is one of the most epic frauds in modern history, reminiscent of the lies told to justify the invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Jeremy, I'm wondering if we can jump for a moment to the beginning of this segment, from October 7th to the UNRWA story, that something like what the Israeli government was alleging, 12, and then that number got larger, members of UNRWA, which has something like 13,000 workers in Gaza, were involved with the October 7th attack. Talk about, if you will, the way you do in your piece, take apart, as Channel 4 did, as a number of news organizations have, the evidence for this that has been used by now almost 20 countries to defund this essential organization that supports the hospitals and the schools of Gaza for over 2 million people.
Well, UNRWA is nothing short of the most important humanitarian organization operating in Gaza. In fact, it was explicitly established in 1949 during the Nakba, where 750,000 plus Palestinians were forced from their homes in an extermination annihilation campaign that then paved the way for the establishment of the State of Israel in the aftermath of World War II. And the mandate of UNRWA was to care for those Palestinians and ensure that their right of return to their homes and land was going to be protected. And so the Israeli government, certainly under Netanyahu, but under other heads of state as well, has always wanted UNRWA eliminated because this represents a very serious problem for the Israeli agenda of eliminating Palestinian territory in its entirety. So just to give that context. But then the Israelis decide that immediately after the International Court of Justice rules in favor of South Africa and orders provisional measures that include the prevention of genocidal acts, the stopping of killing Palestinians that the court recognized as a protected group, and to allow with immediate effect the entry of aid sufficient to confront the humanitarian catastrophe caused by the Israeli war on Gaza. The Israelis then choose to open a new front and just blast the public and the ears of Western leaders with a propaganda campaign aimed at trying to get them to join the crusade to eliminate UNRWA. And Israel then prepared what it called an intelligence dossier, alleging that 12 employees of UNRWA, it has 13,000 or so employees in Gaza, 30,000 employees spread out across the Middle East where displaced Palestinians reside. And the response from the Biden administration was to immediately announce it was suspending all funding to UNRWA. And Secretary of State Antony Blinken admitted publicly that the United States had not even done its own review or investigation of these assertions that 12 members of a 30,000-member organization had some link to the October 7th attacks. And then what happened, and this is so reminiscent of Judy Miller, the New York Times, the Mushroom Cloud, Dick Cheney, build up to the war in Iraq. They go to the Wall Street Journal, and the Israelis provide the Wall Street Journal with what the journal then advertises as a dossier, an intelligence dossier. And they go further than the 12. They say that a full 10% of UNRWA's Gaza staff, 1,200 employees, are connected to Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And they say this is not just a few bad apples. Well, this laundering of Israeli propaganda in the form of an article for a major American newspaper was the lead author of that article was Carrie Keller Lynn. She's a new contributor to the Wall Street Journal. I started digging into who is this person because she didn't have a full bio on the Wall Street Journal website. Well, it turns out that she is a veteran of the Israeli Defense Forces. She is what was a militant opponent of the boycott, divest, sanctions movement when she was at university in the United States. And she, her close friend, who she did a joint interview with for an organization that takes American grad students to Israel, she credits her with, during the 2009 Gaza war, creating the social media strategy for the Israeli Defense Forces. This is the reporter that was the lead journalist writing this UNRWA story for the Wall Street Journal. And once we started to draw attention to that and put photos of her in her IDF uniform and talking about her ties to someone she said helped create the social media strategy for the IDF during a previous war in Gaza. Then these organizations she was affiliated with scrubbed all of these articles and photos from the internet. The journalists locked her Twitter account. But this was very, very clearly a sophisticated propaganda campaign where they knew which journalists to go to, they knew which governments would buy into it. And what they got is the Biden administration now being actively complicit in violating the orders of the International Court of Justice, which has Israel under watch for potential plausible genocidal actions in Gaza.
Finally, Jeremy, do you think on the October 7th investigation that it wasn't simply enough for Israel to say over 1,000 Israelis and other people, majority of them civilian, were killed in the Hamas attack? Was not enough of justification to go into Israel and then multiply that over 27 times to more than 27,000 dead today.
The Israelis, particularly the civilians who were killed that day, deserve the truth about what happened. The Israeli government responded with very heavy firepower. There's indications that the Hannibal Directive may have been invoked, which says that it's better to injure and possibly even kill Israelis than let them be taken hostage. They also made sweeping allegations about sexual violence being systematically committed by Hamas, that they have provided no proof that such a systematic campaign took place. The victims in Israel deserve the truth, and the 30,000 plus Palestinians who have been murdered with American bombs, whose deaths have been justified by the killing of those Israelis, possibly including by their own government, they also deserve the truth.
Jeremy, I'm afraid, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. Jeremy Scahill, senior reporter and correspondent at The Intercept.
You have been listening to journalist Jeremy Scahill of The Intercept discussing his investigation of the now documented fraudulent reports that the Israeli government put out concerning the actions of Hamas fighters on October 7th, featuring lies that have driven the Israeli narrative, picked up and magnified by our government going all the way up to President Biden, and of course echoed by most of our media. They are still driving the narrative today. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time and on KKRN.org, where you can stream us live every Monday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. If you miss a broadcast or want to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to our archive on the internet. Search for truthandjusticeradio.org and then click on This Week in Palestine Archive. It is all there. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will be with us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.